Nothing's certain in politics, but professionals know one thing. Subscribing to the Cook Political Report is the right decision in every election cycle.
For more than four decades, the Cook Political Report has been providing political professionals with the right analysis to help them invest political capital with confidence.
A deep knowledge of the past, combined with a meticulous, unbiased analysis of the present, produces the most accurate predictions of the future, time and time again.
Because it's all backed by data from every input that decides elections for president, Congress, and governorships.
Subscribers to the Cook Political Report get the clarity they need through smart analysis that you won't get anywhere else.
Like the very latest outlook for every race and access to our analysts. Amy Walter, David Wasserman, Carrie Dan, Jessica Taylor, Aaron Covey, and Matthew Klein.
The Cook Political Report offers
the right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
For getting it right.
Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe.
Welcome to The Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. It is not an exaggeration to say that I've been wanting to have my guest today, Carlos Odio, on this podcast for at least a year. Carlos, who's the co-founder of Ecce's Research, has a deep and nuanced understanding of Latino voters, a group that gets discussed a lot in the media, but not with the complexity and nuance the topic deserves. Carlos has been working to understand what's been driving these Latino voters from Democrats and what could be done to pull them back. He's now emerging with new information to share with us, including a national poll his firm, Ecce's, did with Latino voters. Hot tip, my colleague, Carrie Dan, wrote about this, and you can read her story on cookpolitical.com. Anyway, Carlos and I talk about what the polling revealed about Latino perceptions of Trump, the economy, what it all means for 2026. And we take a deep dive into the high-stakes races for the House and Senate in Texas, a state where Latino voters shifted considerably toward Trump in 2024. We recorded this conversation on Wednesday, July 8th. Carlos Odio, hello. It has been a while. I'm so glad to reconnect with you.
Hello, Amy Walter. It's so good to see you. I think last I saw you was in Chicago in 2024 at the Democratic National Convention. And it feels like a few things have happened since then.
Couple things since then. Maybe we should talk about those. But I'm going to start you, Carlos, with your own survey, or the survey done by your organization, Ecce's national poll taken earlier this summer of Hispanic voters. There's a lot to dig into there, but I want you to give me your top-level takeaways, and then we'll dig in.
Absolutely. So this was a poll focused on the economy. It is part of a regular series of polls we do checking in on registered Latino voters nationally. And what's interesting is, unlike some other public opinion polling, we had seen Trump fairly stable among Latino voters in terms of job approval since last summer. So he had come into office. There were high hopes about him. Those hopes had come down summer of 2025, a little bit after Liberation Day. And then for the rest of 2025, it had been kind of stable into early 2026. And it's only now in this late May poll that we saw those numbers start to drop, and they started dropping in a pretty dramatic fashion. So something has changed. Whereas there had been not the cascade that others had been seeing, but something had changed. And yet, there was so much ground for Democrats to make up that even now, they still haven't returned to some of the earlier highs. And so what we're tracking is the extent to which there is a gap between where Democrats find themselves now and where they've been in the past, even if they've come forward so far from where they were in the 2024 election, kind of the nadir of the Biden period. And this being an economy poll, we found the reasons driving it, right? The discontent specifically around after the Iran war and all that has come to a head as far as cost of living.
So do you think the Iran war really was the catalyst for this drop, Carlos? Or was it just that after this amount of time, voters were feeling just the cumulative weight of things that had happened over the course of the year?
It certainly seems aggregate. In fact, when you ask voters who voted for Trump, who now feel like they regret their vote or at least disappointed, and you ask them why, the top reason is just that they feel like promises were broken. Mm-hmm. It's not any specific promise. It's just a sense that there was a vision that Trump promised and that step by step, he has not delivered on those. Down the list, you go to how he's handled the economy and cost of living, how he has handled the Iran war. Why the Iran war matters, I think, is because it put to a lie this idea that something was, that there was a corner that was going to get turned and everything was all of a sudden going to get better. We had, if you look at voters' top issue, Latino voters' top issue, since he got into office, you can kind of see the story of crisis upon crisis, where in that spring of 2025 into the summer, you have the tariffs. You also have Kilmar Abrego Garcia. You start having these stories of immigration overreach. You then have the economy throughout this rising in importance as a number one issue, and yet still rising in salience throughout all of this. You then have another spike in immigration around Minnesota. Then immigration starts dropping, and in its place comes Iran. And parallel with Iran, cost of living in the economy rise even more in salience, where now a majority of Latino voters identify the economy as their top issue. So you see how it all converges into a story of Trump ran on a series of things. He had a variety of opportunities coming into office with Latino voters and kind of systematically has squandered them one by one.
And yet, and this was a point you made in your opening, and yet it doesn't seem that this drop in support for Trump or this frustration with promises not being kept is benefiting Democrats. You know, this idea that, well, maybe the president's not doing so well on the economy, but at least Democrats will do something better, is not there. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. First of all, even though Trump's approval has now dropped, it has only now reached the low levels that he had seen in his first term. So even though Trump's second term has been objectively a political debacle, if you look at the YouGov weekly tracking of Trump's approval among Hispanics, even now throughout his term, the second term, he has tracked above where he was in his first term. So even as things were going down, he still was not as unpopular as he was when he came into office. It is only now that the lines have converged.
So is this that these voters were giving Trump, Latino voters were giving Trump a benefit of the doubt in 2024 that they weren't giving him after 2016?
That's exactly right. So he comes into office in 2016 and there was incredibly low expectations among Latino voters. He only got 30% of the Latino vote in 2016. You then see the two presidential elections that follow, right? And over the course of those two elections, he gains 16 points among Latinos. So he goes from 30% to, by 2024, 46%.
Right.
That was not about the last 4 months of 2024. That was about dynamics underway throughout that 8-year period. In his first term, Trump enjoyed a pretty solid economy. Actually, if you look at the last 15 years, some of the lowest prices over that period were in 2018, 2019, before the pandemic. Hispanic unemployment was at a historic low, which still hasn't been matched. He was benefiting in many ways from the Obama recovery post the Great Recession. And so all of a sudden, this idea of Trump the businessman managing an incredible economy unlocked the door for him among a certain kind of skeptical conservative Latino who all of a sudden found a reason to support him.
Yep.
And so that's the story of 2020. 2024, all of a sudden, people voted for Joe Biden expecting a return to normalcy after the pandemic. And instead what happened was crisis upon crisis upon crisis. No trust in Biden's ability personally to lead us out of that crisis, in his abilities as a messenger. And Trump, by comparison, if you look at retrospective approvals for Donald Trump, they improve among Latinos, as they did among other people as well. And people started saying, well, by comparison, I'd rather go back to that economy than what we're living through right now. At the same time, I should say, that you have these larger culture war fights. There is these like larger debates and I say this to people all the time, like, we can make it about the Democratic Party, but these are happening across Western democracies. It's just that it was late in coming to certain groups, and Latinos is one of those groups. Among Latinos, group identity, other ethnic elements were holding, especially conservative Latinos, from supporting Republicans. And then all of a sudden, though, they start looking a lot more like the rest of the electorate. And there starts to be an ideological alignment where conservatives become Republicans, Republicans become more conservative, Democrats become more liberal. And the problem is for Democrats is that you don't reverse that overnight. Once you start moving to what is your quote unquote political home, that's a hard dynamic to reverse. And so even now, while the Republican brand has gone down, we've seen on key elements, how in terms of who gets things done, Republicans had a big advantage on that in 2024. That's decreased. Who is the party of order and stability? The share of Latinos saying that describes Republicans has gone down under Trump 2.0. Fave on faves of Republican Party have gone down in Trump 2.0. But the Democratic brand hasn't improved. And our last poll, Dem fave on faves, was plus one. A year before it had been plus four. You're not seeing any improvement necessarily in the estimation of Democrats. That doesn't mean they're not going to do well in 2026, because I think they will do well with Latinos in 2026. But how well they do will determine the outcome in a bunch of House races.
That is an excellent point. And I want to dig into that for a minute, Carlos. So if we look overall at the Hispanic electorate and say, how much of a percentage of those voters now would fit into the categories of pretty solidly Democratic? These are going to be liberal, not really going to move between election and election between Democrat, Republican, solid Republican, and then the swing in between. And then we can kind of dig into who are swing voters among Latinos, because Carlos, you and I have talked about this for so long. Almost every election, there is a swing vote that everyone wants to talk about. And for most elections that I have covered, they've usually been white people, right? Is it white women? Is it white working class men? Is it, right? NASCAR dads, soccer moms. And we always talked about people of color in this little box, and they always sat over here on, well, that's the Democratic side, and let's talk about these other people. Now we have to talk about Latino voters as swing voters. So if you can help us sort of break down, and again, this is just like with any demographic group, this is not a monolith. Not all women think the same, not all, et cetera, et cetera. But if we just think broadly about this demographic group, how should we be thinking of these voters in that category, just from a ideological and partisan sense?
Excellent question. Let me tell you where I think we stand right now, how I would think about segmenting the electorate, because we did this exercise at the beginning of this cycle where you look at not just party identification, but you look at people's values, their social and cultural values, or how they view gender, sexuality. You look at how they voted in the past. And essentially, Latinos, registered Latinos, about 50% are truly Democratic. That is the Democratic starting point, about 50%. The Republican starting point, beginning of the cycle, was about 37%. Now, that's what Trump got in 2020 among Latinos. So it represents kind of a post-shift starting point, meaning some people sticking around. Of that 37%, I'd say there's some softness. So 29% is like the Republican basement. There are 29% of Latinos.
That's the floor right now.
That's the floor for Republicans. 29% of Latinos are going to vote for Republicans when they turn out. But between the softness on both sides and the people who are true swing in the middle, a full third of Hispanics are persuadable. And Amy, as you were saying, the challenge is we try to shoehorn into this into other existing frameworks.
Right.
And one is, a traditional way to think of Latino voters is as a mobilization universe. Will Latinos turn out is the main question I still get to this moment. But the wall between turnout and persuasion is a false wall. The swing voters are also the low propensity voters. People who are less likely to vote also happen to be less partisan. They're less locked into their ways. And turnout and persuasion tend to move in the same direction. And so 2024 is a great example of this. People said, well, Trump did better among Latinos because the Biden voters stayed home. But here's what I would tell you. We asked the voters who stayed home, how would you have voted if you had turned out in 2024. If all Latinos had voted, Donald Trump would have done even better among Latino voters because he had this strength with low propensity Latinos. Now, if somehow miraculously only the Biden voters had returned, sure, that would have helped Kamala Harris a little bit. But even there, Donald Trump would have taken a big chunk out of it. There was a segment of Biden voters who said, if I had voted, I would have voted for Donald Trump. And so the way to understand this is you had people who were discontented, some of which expressed that discontent by crossing over and voting for Donald Trump. Many others expressed it by not voting at all. But the choice of who to vote for and whether to vote at all often goes hand in hand. And that's a fundamental way in which we have to think about Latinos, especially as you go into a midterm year, right, in which the turnout dynamics are so important, which is we still need to be thinking about support even when we think that there is a turnout dynamic in the mix. I do have, if you'll allow me.
Please.
A step back point on this though too, which is
yes.
Latinos are not fully base vote. They're not fully swing either. They have not realigned to the Republican Party, but they have de-aligned from the Democratic Party. There's a long term over a 35 year period trend away from identifying as Democrats and only recently a slight uptick in identifying as Republican. They don't fit Latinos into the black-white binary among which American society and politics tends to be organized. They are in many ways triple underdogs, by which I mean minorities, working class, and often foreign-coded, even if they themselves are not foreign. That is, in American society, a triple underdog scenario. And so what that means is Latinos truly are in the middle. They're kind of stuck between a lot of different dynamics. And the main dynamic is that there is still this traditional allegiance with the Democratic Party. Because the Democratic Party is the party of the underdogs and the little guy. That's an age-old dynamic. You know, a lot of people try to trace back the origin of Latino partisanship to the Civil Rights era. And the Civil Rights era did cement it, as it did among black voters. But a majority of Mexican and Puerto Rican voters were already voting for Democrats before the Civil Rights era because of the New Deal. It was an economic understanding.
It was an economic push. Yeah.
It was an economic push. It was a push. Look, other immigrants, you know, European immigrants shifted to became Democrats after the New Deal as well, because there was a sense overall that there is the party of the little guy, and that's the Democratic Party. And so even as new immigrants were coming into the party in the early 2000s, even then, that image still shaped, all things being equal, what's going to be my default? Where do I think I belong? And that still is true for most Hispanics. All things being equal, I'm going to go vote for the Democrats. But there are forces pushing them to the right. There's like erosion, a lot of societal changes that are pulling them in that direction. And so you kind of get stuck in this protracted limbo. And that's the way we kind of have to understand Latino voters right now. They don't fit into any of the other existing boxes we have in the electorate, but they're not so complicated that we can't understand where they fit in any one moment if we pay a little bit of closer attention.
Let's dig into that limbo piece there, Carlos, because then the next piece of conversation when we talk about limbo with swing voters is it a cultural thing or is it an economic thing that is really the bigger dynamic pulling those voters one way or the other, right? So Democrats say, we're going to talk like working class messengers. We're going to address issues like affordability, minimum wage. We're going to make sure that we are seen once again as the party of the working class. And there are others who would say Democrats can't be the party of the working class if culturally they are more aligned with sort of white elite institutional language around things like gender, sexuality, abortion. Can you address that?
So is it the economy or is it cultural? And I love the question because the economy is often not just the economy.
Right.
The economy is not just a number. The economy is cultural. The economy can be cultural. Mm. And that's what we're talking about here, that the economy can also be about recognition and belonging and purpose. And if you think about those who are immigrants or those who are descended from immigrants, the ethos, the reason to come to this country was to work hard to get ahead. And that becomes a purpose, right? To be a provider and a protector for your family. And that's not just even the first generation, that's descended. You're told the stories of, this is why your grandfather came to this country, is for you to be a provider and a protector. And so that becomes its own identity, that is becomes linked into culture. And it becomes a question of where do I think protectors and providers belong? Once it was kind of obvious that it would be Democrats, like I said, all things being equal, that is still the default. But there were more people who started buying into the MAGA narrative in 2024. And the MAGA narrative is, you know, there's this this deep story that Arlene Hochschild tells about MAGA, which is, you know, you're waiting your turn in line for the American dream.
Oh, right. Yep.
Right.
And all these people are cutting in front of
you. And all these people are cutting in front of you in line. Yep. And who's fighting for you and who's cheering on the people cutting in line for you? And so the idea that Democrats and that Joe Biden were cheering on the people who are cutting in line in front of you. And what's funny about that story, right, is that that story was told to explain, you know, MAGA support in the Deep South among, like,
that's right,
you know, among white.
Yes. And that it was people of color cutting in front of them.
And it was people of color cutting in line. But guess what? People of color feel that way as well, right? The narrative, once it was able to be broadened, right, once you took out that element, and by the way, the book is appropriately called Strangers in Their Own Land,
yes,
which is a great title for a book about immigrants who are feeling resentment in a moment like this. And in 2024, that's what you had, was a resentment. It was feeling, they wouldn't call it resentment. They would say it was a matter of fairness. They would say, I've been waiting my turn in line, and there are people jumping in front of me. And you could make it just racial. You could say it's handouts. But it wasn't just that. It was Ukraine. It was a group after group of people telling us we are spending money in Ukraine that should be spent here instead. It was about new immigrants crossing the border who they were told were getting benefits. They were getting legal status. They were getting checks. And they themselves weren't getting that. Not only that, you were talking about people who their own undocumented family had been waiting years in line for some sort of relief and they weren't getting it, and someone crossing the border today was. What Trump was able to do in that moment was take advantage, exploit this feeling, which is a widespread one, right, in that exact moment. Now, since then, we could talk about what he's done, which is essentially squander the opportunity he had there, right? If Ukraine and the sense of America first was something that started resonating among Latinos, well, he's done everything in his power to get us into other foreign adventures and relay the idea that he is putting other people ahead of you, which is the very thing that people had felt about Democrats. And it's why so many more people now feel in limbo today.
A quick break, and we'll be back with Carlos Odio.
Hey there, it's Erin Covey, the House Editor here at the Cook Political Report. Did you know we have another podcast called Editor's Roundtable? It comes out once a week and features me and my colleagues pulling back the curtain to let you in on all of our insights on races, ratings changes, polling, and everything else we'll be following this midterm year. You can find Editor's Roundtable on Apple Podcasts for just $1.99 a month, or become a paying subscriber to our new Cook Political Report Substack. All this is linked in the episode's show notes.
I want to talk about this issue of immigration, sort of move us off of the economy. But as you noted, you can never really move off the economy, even when you're talking about things that don't seem linked to the economy. But Carlos, I watch a lot of ads, political ads. I'm sure you do as well. And as I'm watching Democratic primary ads, almost all of them include a reference to ICE. We're going to either defund it as Democrats, we're going to reform it. I look at your poll, and among Hispanic voters, this issue of overreach by the Trump administration or ICE or deportations ranks pretty low on their list of issues that they say are the most important to them. Even among people who say they're defecting, or it's not defecting, they feel disappointed by their vote for Trump, don't list ICE or immigration that highly. So can you help us understand the role that immigration is or is not playing in the way that Hispanic voters are judging Trump and the two parties?
The salience of immigration has fluctuated during Trump's term. If you look at some of our polling from earlier this year after Minnesota, the people who were disappointed in Trump were citing immigration much more. If you look at last summer, people were citing immigration much more. It's just that those have been supplanted by other new, fresher concerns. But they're all kind of in a mix. You know, some point we tested a Democratic economic message against the Republican economic message. And the Democratic message outperformed the Republican one, but not by that much more. But when you linked an economic message and an immigration message, it way outperformed the Republican one. Recently, we tried this with other issues. You combine economy and corruption, let's say, and it also outperforms an economy only. And it is to say a narrative that ties together the various Trump issues speaks more to this moment than anything that's simply one-dimensional. The idea that Trump has the wrong priorities, that Trump cares about others, that Trump and his allies care about others other than you, tying that together using various proof points is more powerful. But it's true that immigration on its own is not gonna do it.
It's not the driver.
I don't think any one issue on its own is gonna do it, but it is part of a larger story, the immigration overreach, the idea that people thought he would focus narrowly on criminals, on recent border crossers, and then all of a sudden what he's doing is breaking up hardworking American families. That is something that has been widely rejected.
Now I wanna look specifically at 2026, Carlos. Again, looking at your poll, your survey shows Democrats leading on the generic ballot with Hispanic voters by 21 points. Now, on the one hand, that's a pretty good number, given that in 2024, when I went back and looked at the exit polls, looked at the House vote, Democrats only won Hispanics by 10 points. But if you go back to 2018, to your larger point, Democrats won this group of voters by 40 points. So what does this tell us in this moment, that Democrats are doing better than they did in 2024, but they're not doing as great as they did in 2018? And do Democrats need to hit that 2018 number in order to be successful? Or is it just that they do better than they did last cycle?
So you take the generic ballot nationally today, it's 54-33, like you said, plus 21. If you allocate the undecideds proportionally, that gets you 62% Latino, Democrat, 62% Democrat among Latinos in the two-way vote. So 62, as you said, is higher than 2024, which was 57. It is even a smidge above 2022, which was 61. But it's still below 2018, and it's still below 2016. 2018, the number was 2016, it was 66 for House, not for president. At House level.
I'm looking at.
And these are Catalyst numbers, Catalyst estimates of Hispanic support in prior years. For 2018, we can anchor there, it was 71% national support. So we're at 62 now, 2018 was 71%. Obviously a lot of geographic variation in 2018, you know, Republicans improved in Florida, there were pockets in Texas where perhaps they improved, maybe a little bit in Nevada, but overall, 71%. That divide, right, is where a lot of races are going to get decided, because the House map, as you well know this year, is very Latino. It's actually disproportionately Latino. So, you know, Latinos are 13% of all eligible voters. They're 20% of eligible voters in the, you know, 38 most competitive races as rated by Cook. You have 12 seats that are at least 20% Latino. And to put that into perspective, Nevada, which we think of as like the Latino state in a presidential race, is about 20% Latino. Mm. So in the House map, you have about 12 Nevadas. Six of those are majority Latino. They're over 50% Latino or Hispanic. So it's a pretty damn Hispanic map. And in a place like Texas, which we can talk about more, if you were able to rewind the clock of Hispanic support to 2020, yes, some seats become more winnable. But there are some seats that are only winnable if you rewind the clock as Democrats back to 2018.
Is that at all possible? Do you believe that 2018 was the high water mark that just represents an era that no longer exists in the same way that we can think of, you know, go back to the 80s and look at how Democrats did with conservative white voters, right? We say, well, that was then. We can't go back to that place. We got to be realistic about where Democrats can succeed in the future. Should Democrats be looking at 2018 and thinking, oh yeah, that's absolutely doable. Or do they need to actually think of this as the 62% as where the more realistic share of the vote they can hope to get?
I certainly think Democrats should not settle for the 62%. And certainly I think the trend line favors Democrats. I certainly don't think Trump seems in any rush to help his party overcome their disadvantages. The generic ballot naturally, not among Latinos, but the general population seems to suggest 2018 is a possible scenario.
Yep.
But a lot of this comes down, Amy, to, you know, in 2022, we didn't have one national contest, right?
Right.
We had battleground states and we had non-battleground states. I think you could see differences in different states or regions within those states. Yep. In 2026, because a lot of this is going to come down to candidate effects as well. I mean, we could talk, my favorite example, of course, because it's everyone's favorite example, is Texas 15. Texas 15 is Republican Monica de la Cruz is the incumbent. It's yep. a seat that actually was not redrawn. Texas redrew. Texas 15 changed very, very, very little.
Yep.
But it's a seat that if you were to rewind the clock to 2022, Republicans would still hold it. You rewind the clock to 2020, Republicans would still hold it. If you rewind the clock to 2018 or 2016, Democrats win it. It is not just, though, about nationally where is the Democratic brand going, but also then do you have candidates who can differentiate themselves enough from the generic Democratic brand
exactly
to eke out some narrow victories. And in Texas 15, you have Bobby Pulido as a Democrat, who's this super popular Tejano singer known throughout the area, who's not a especially partisan figure. You know, one of his campaign slogans is, I'm not Team Red, I'm not Team Blue, I'm Team You. The guy's good at this stuff. You know, he's off playing quinceañeras because his opponent said he doesn't belong in this race. He belongs playing quinceañeras. And so he said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go play some quinceañeras. And he's doing it in the region for anybody who requests it. And it's that kind of campaign that I think can help move Democrats past some of the ugliness of the Biden years, especially in these close races. So I don't think this is just a national question. I think it's that plus what are they doing in individual districts?
I think that's exactly right. And I look, though, at a state like Texas. Let's move statewide for a second. Look at a state like Texas and then look at a state like Florida. And again, in the olden days, like let's say the Obama era, we sort of put Florida into this is a winnable state. These are Hispanic voters that favor Democrats because culturally they're more in line with Democrats. And in Texas, they are more culturally conservative. And as such, it's harder for Democrats to win. Now, here we are in 2026 and all eyes are on Texas and the idea of James Tyler Rico flipping that Senate seat, and no one's talking about Florida anymore. So can you unwind those two states for us, please, and help us understand what is going on in those two states?
As a Florida native, a Miamian, your statement breaks my heart, but it's no less true. that nobody cares about Florida right now. It's, you know,
I mean,
it's a parlor game.
We care, Carlos. We care. We just are, you know, it's just not in the top tier of conversation. How about that?
You know, to the extent that money is an expression of values,
yes.
The campaign spending, national spending, would suggest that nobody cares.
Fair.
And, you know, it's a question I've been asking for a few years. Would Democrats win statewide first in Texas or in Florida? And, you know, right now you'd probably choose Texas. And you saw the New York Times Siena poll in Texas. Very encouraging for Tyler Rico. On the Hispanic side, if he held the numbers he has today, it would be a modern high among Hispanics in Texas. We don't have another comparison for where he's at right now. I think he was 61-29.
Yeah, he was. I went back and looked. It was like he was up. I just took the margin. He was up like 21 or 22.
But if you look on the same poll, if you look at the generic ballot,
yep.
So if you look at congressional voting,
yes.
It is much narrower.
Yep.
It would be better than 2020, but below 2016 or 2018.
Yes. Yes.
To our previous conversation.
Yes.
And, you know, you'd think there was a lot of ticket splitting in 2022, but ticket splitting has reduced over time. You'd think those numbers start to converge somewhat. Question is, in which direction do they converge, or to the benefit of which party? But I'd say Tallarico is still a long shot, but it becomes less of a long shot every day. If there is a set of circumstances under which Democrats can win in that state, it's got to be these. And the rest of the map for Democrats and the Senate side is so challenging that Texas becomes even more attractive. Trump's approval in the state has been dropping as well. It was actually kind of narrow. At some point, he was in positive territory in Texas. It has been dropping. So the conditions are there. And certainly, it looks like Tallarico is putting together the kind of coalition that you'd need, meaning very high numbers, not just among Black voters, but also among Hispanic voters, and then some crossover, that you are getting some percent of Republicans either staying home or, better yet, crossing the aisle.
But he did very, very well in the primary. Granted, this is a Democratic primary in South Texas among Latino voters. Is there something about Tallarico? Why do you think he's doing as well? And as you said, even in the crosstabs of this most recent New York Times poll, he's holding on to Latino support. How does he code differently, do you think, for Latinos than a generic Democrat?
Yeah, we said earlier part of what happened among Latinos in the Trump era was increased sorting and polarization, right? Where all of a sudden cultural divides matter a whole lot more. And so you have left-right divides guiding the Latino vote in a way that it hadn't necessarily in the past. Tallarico, I think, does a good job of scrambling those signals when he talks about making this about top versus bottom instead of left versus right. It's similar to what I just said about Bobby Peluto, who said not Team Blue, not Team Red, but Team U. It is people who are willing to or trying to get out of the old fights. People don't want to be stuck in the same old fights, especially because it's gotten us to the place we're at today. And I think that's part of the Tallarico appeal, is that he doesn't seem like every other Republican or Democrat before him. You know, some of that I think is about how he talks about his faith. You know, I don't love the caricature of Latinos as being somehow more religious than the rest of the population. I think that's like an old stereotype. I don't think that's what guides the vote necessarily. If anything, the trend among Latinos that sticks out to me is the growth in the unaffiliated, in the atheists and agnostics. But still, talking about faith, being comfortable with religion, is about the cultural signals it sends. It's about who you're welcoming into your coalition. And for Democrats to get past the 62% among Latinos, they're going to have to welcome back defectors. There are Latinos who voted for Donald Trump, who they're going to need to welcome back. And for a lot of, you know, activists on Blue Sky, that's not comfortable. There's a lot of chastising of Latinos who voted for Donald Trump. But it's going to take people sucking it up and saying, you were lied to. Promises were made to you and they were broken. And welcoming those voters with open arms. For that's what it's going to take for Democrats to improve their numbers among Latinos.
Before I let you go, I want to get your opinion about what we could learn from 2026 that may guide us in 2028. We all recognize that a midterm election is different. We just talked for an extensive amount of time about the fact that the 2018 success that Democrats had with Latinos was not only a high mark, but may have hidden some of the challenges that Democrats should have thought about as they went into 2020. In fact, there's an argument to be made, Carlos, that Democrats looked at that number and that success with Latinos and said, here, what we need to do is actually move to the left on immigration. What are you looking at right now from 2026 to help guide your thinking and the advice that you could give Democrats in how to think about these voters and the messages that matter going into the presidential?
Here's how I think about this. Imagine you were back in early 2017. I don't think there's anyone outside of zealots who would have predicted that Trump would make the gains he did among Latinos in the two elections that followed, myself included. And I think that's because the frameworks we had at the time were insufficient for the task, were inadequate. Here we kind of stand at another turning point. And I get concerned that we're also ill-equipped to understand what might come next. But that's why I'm so obsessed with making sure we are learning the right lessons from the last decade, so that we don't end up in the whiplash we're in right now. So we're in the vacuum right now, where we don't have a good operating theory of Latino voters. We keep jumping from Latinos are so gone for Democrats to Latinos are so back for Democrats, like from moment to moment, often based on cloudy tea leaves. I think a more resilient model of Latino voters does understand that they are these in-between Americans who have a political home in Democrats in good times, but are feeling the tug, cultural tug, toward Republicans. And what that means is we get deeper into understanding the ways in which Latinos are in the middle, that they're in the second generation moment. It's a lot of children of immigrants who now are predominant, which is unique in the history of Latino voters. If we think about the ways that they feel stuck between two different views on immigration, where they want public safety at the border, but they don't want overreach when it comes to what you do about those who have been established here for a long time. You know, you look at it in some and you say, Democrats are gonna do better among Latino voters in 2026. But based on what we are learning, we have to be able to also say, that doesn't mean that 2028 is a safe bet for Democrats among Latinos. That still, like kind of the grooves of the old age run so deep that you are not going to erase that overnight. And so you essentially have this midterm. The result will be what it is. It's a skirmish and a longer and a bigger battle. You're going to have a Democratic primary where you are going to have the most progressive Latinos voting in those primaries. If you go back to 2020, Latinos boosted Bernie Sanders in Nevada. We came out of that primary saying, wow, Latinos are all socialists, right? Like that was like the take on Latinos. And then all of a sudden the general election happened and says, maybe they're not. And so you also have to survive the silly season of the Democratic primary where people are also going to try and anticipate that in 2028, a lot of these low propensity voters, the swingiest Latino voters, are still here on the sidelines watching and waiting. And the decisions that they make, are not obvious to us today. There are still choices that the parties can make between now and then to shift the Latino vote in one direction or the other. Latino vote is stuck between these two big tectonic major forces of decades. They're historical, they're psychological, and yet there is this third that are persuadable, and they're gonna fluctuate from cycle to cycle. So what I view as my job to close it is to just anticipate that with people like you, with people who pay close attention, to say all of this fits within a larger pattern. And we just cannot overread any one given moment because it is a protracted limbo Latinos are on and it's not going to get resolved overnight.
Carlos, that was a perfect ending. I so appreciate you taking this time to talk to me. You made us all a lot smarter and really, really appreciate that. Enjoy the rest of this day, this summer, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you, Amy. It is always a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman.